This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Just to say that for rights reasons, the music in the original radio broadcast has been removed for this podcast. Good morning and welcome to the programme. Today I can promise you some powerful music, the story of two overlooked women who financially supported their much more famous brothers, and why some believe that America ought to look to France when it comes to enshrining women's rights into a constitution. I say this on so-called Super Tuesday, the biggest day so far in the 2024 race for the White House, as voters in 15 states and one US territory choose candidates for the next president. But first, coming closer to home on the political front, people living in Birmingham are facing a 21% rise in their council tax bill over the next 2 years, as Birmingham City Council, the largest local authority in Europe, is also set to vote on a wave of cuts to local services, including bin collections, dimming of the streetlights, the adult social care budget, and closing 25 of the city's 35 public libraries. As ever, women will be disproportionately affected by some of those cuts if they go ahead, as society's primary carers, both professionally and personally. But as some are also pointing out, to make matters worse, women and their demands to be paid equally are being blamed again for the hole in the council's budget. And yet a new theory has emerged that has nothing to do with the equal pay claim. Instead, it could all be about a faulty IT system. On this programme, we do try to bring you not just the news we think you need to be aware of, but also the stories behind it and how they impact women's lives directly and the perception of women in society. This story has both. And if you have anything to say about the potential of higher bills and how you're coping at the moment, especially ahead of the Chancellor's budget tomorrow, I'd love to hear from you. 84844 is the number you need to text. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can drop me an email through the Woman's Hour website, or WhatsApp on 03700 100 444. Just watch those charges. If you live in Birmingham and you have anything you want to get off your chest, especially when you hear a bit more detail about this story, also please feel free to get in touch using those same numbers. But let me tell you who I'm joined by now on the line. I've got Heather Jameson, editor of the Municipal Journal, and Dr. James Brackley, lecturer in accounting at Sheffield University, who's written an article today for the news site, The Conversation, about this issue in Birmingham. And good morning, James. I should also say, if I start with you, you're a Birmingham resident. Your PhD is and your PhD is in local authority finance. So you do have a focus on this. Tell us a bit more about the reality versus what seems to be sometimes being blamed on women's equality or case for pay equality here.
Yeah, so thank you. Good morning. So, yeah, so we've done quite a bit of work through something called the Audit Reform Lab, looking at the latest accounts and paperwork as it comes out in Birmingham. And what we're seeing, particularly when we look at the sort of support package that was put in place by the government, is there was a sort of pretty high profile £700 million equal pay liability that was announced in September last year. And that was, you know, widely cited as the main reason for the bankruptcy.
And just to say on that, that was female council workers demanding equal pay to men who worked at the council. We've covered the story a number of times on Woman's Hour, but just in case people forget, do carry on.
Fantastic. Yeah, so that's absolutely right. But what we're noticing is a couple of things. I think one is on the timing. So there was very little understanding really of how that amount was reached at from various sources within the council, really. And that was sort of publicised before that liability had been shared with the auditors. And it still, as of March 2024, hasn't been audited. So it seems a little bit premature to publicise it at that point in time. And now with our analysis, we're able to see that on the back of the failed implementation of the Oracle IT system, that they would have been bankrupt anyway, essentially. So we're seeing, even after the biggest ever cuts that we've ever seen announced recently, there's still a £240 million budget gap, none of which relates to equal pay. And there's a £400 million black hole in reserves, again, after you take away the £700 million equal pay liability. So
there was analysis shows that there would have been effective bankruptcy without the equal pay claims.
Yes, absolutely. So that seems to be the case. So we're fairly confident on that point now. And the council's been in chaos, really, with regards to Oracle. So we've seen documents that have suggested 70,000 transaction errors, not been able to collect council tax debt, not been able to monitor the budget.
Again, I don't wish to interrupt unnecessarily, but Oracle, it may be the first time anyone's heard of this particular IT issue. Of course, people may be thinking of another glitched IT system when they're thinking of the post office, for instance, and what's gone on there. But just, I know it's not your area of expertise, but this is a system that the council has to have to be able to run itself, collect money from others. Is that why it's so important?
Yeah, indeed. So everything from all of the payroll for the tens of thousands of staff to the council tax and business rates for a million residents to parking charges, all of these transactions go through the Oracle IT system.
And this IT system hasn't been working?
No, it's been a complete disaster. So it was implemented in April 2022 and it sort of came to light in the subsequent 12 months, really. Through various committees, that it was posting very large volumes of transaction errors. And that was meaning the council was having to employ hundreds and hundreds of staff and very expensive consultants to address all of these transaction errors and try and fix this broken system. So in terms of the costs in the budget, it is very much Oracle that we see as what's really pushing Birmingham over the edge. Bearing in mind they've had a decade of austerity and, very deep cuts as well already.
So what do you see as the reason, bringing this back to the women who some have seen be repeatedly blamed, or rather their equal pay case be blamed for the state of the council's finances? What do you think the reason is for not being as clear, which seems to be what you're alleging here, as clear as possible as to what has caused the issue financially?
So, yeah, I don't want to speculate too much, but it's clearly a very political issue in terms of, who's to blame for the crisis and who's held accountable. But what's especially disappointing for me and for our analysis and for myself as a resident of Birmingham is that if this had been recognised as an Oracle disaster, I think there would have been much more focus and scrutiny on assessing the financial position and doing a proper value for money assessment, because we're seeing really crucial cuts to statutory services, families, children's services, adult social care, where there's been no equalities impact assessment, no value for money assessment. And in many cases, we're seeing cuts that are going to implement, increased costs in future. There was an £11 million overspend for temporary accommodation last year. We've got over 2,000 children in care in Birmingham. So I think much more focus needed to be put on getting this budget right, whereas I think arguably the politics and the equal pay has become quite a distraction from that.
We received a statement from Birmingham City Council in which it said savings of more than £300 million need to be made over the next two financial years. The council's priority is to deliver and live within a balanced budget. The level of savings is unprecedented and the council will continue to face financial pressures in order to meet its wide-ranging statutory duties and protect those residents most in need of support. This time of significant change for Birmingham City Council means we need to fundamentally change how we deliver services, including involving our residents and communities far more in decisions we must take. Let me bring in, as I told you we would, Heather Jameson, editor of the Municipal Journal. Heather, just listening what James had to say there, what would be your response?
So I think he is partly right and partly wrong. I think there is a lot to do with the Oracle system, but I think the one thing that I would say is that there is a number of issues going on here for Birmingham. There is there's Equal Pay Oracle, a near 30% cut in their funding since austerity began in 2010. Inflation, rising demands across adult social care, children's social care, and housing and homelessness. And all of these things have all added to the mix. I would also say that the equal pay issue, I appreciate it may feel to women who work in Birmingham that it's blaming them. I don't think the council is taking as much responsibility for that as it needs to. I think the issue that you have is that the equal pay was solved in 2012. It was all resolved. But because there were bin strikes later on in, I think, about 2015, the bin men had a pay rise, which then reintroduced inequality in the pay. This is not a problem that should be blamed on the women. It should be blamed on the council actually making a mistake in the way that they handled the bin strikes of 2015.
So it's compounded, the issue, afterwards.
It was. So it was on the way to being resolved, and then it was reintroduced again, the inequality in pay.
How aware, though, do you think the public are to that myriad of reasoning, but also about this potential IT system situation? Because if you're seeing your council tax bill go up by such a significant amount, especially with a lot of people finding things very difficult as it is. I mean, do you think that, you know, you working in the area that you do and covering local governments and local councils and how it works, do you think people are tuning in more to this?
So I think it's starting to get a lot more publicity now, as you'll be aware. But if you look at your news story, the top of your news story this morning.
The BBC.
The BBC news story. They were talking about Jeremy Hunt dealing with or talking about issues around cuts to council funding, and his response to that in the budget is going to be to cut diversity funding. Well, you know, having a diversity officer, which seems to be one of the issues that this government is focusing on, is not going to save Birmingham or cost Birmingham the £300 million that it's got to fund over the next 2 years. The central government is trying to deflect the lack of funding that they have put into local government by raising issues not really worth the amount of money that they're talking about.
And I suppose just coming to accountability, and, you know, that's what you and I do as journalists. We try to hold those with power, with money to account, or with money, I should say, for public good and public use. Again, sort of coming back to a lot of people will think, well, perhaps it's because of the payout that they have to do, not necessarily because of all those things and this IT system. Is there any way of avoiding this in the future or as we move forward? Have you got any glimmers of hope? Because it's not just Birmingham. You've looked across the UK and there are a number of councils in this situation.
No, that's right. This year there was 19 councils who were given capitalisation directives. I won't go into the technical details of that for you and bore your readers, but basically allowed to borrow more money in order to prop up their finances. That's more than double than we've ever had before. So I think at the moment it's something that the sector is concentrating on very, very carefully. The government has introduced something called OFLOG, the Office of Local Government, which will be looking at the data to try and predict which councils are going to be financially struggling and failing in other ways over the coming years. But I think there is an issue that actually I think all of us with our personal finances would know that if you had a third of your budget cut, of your household budget cut, you would be struggling, particularly when we're all facing inflation and the difficulties that we have at the moment.
And just finally to you, Heather, in terms of the government, the council, excuse me, taking responsibility about those equal pay cases and for those women, because I can imagine, just putting it in human terms, that some of those women today may feel pretty bad. You know, may feel, wrongly so, in the sense of because they won their case fair and square and were being underpaid. But they may feel like it's come to their door in some way, especially when this is talked about. Not for the first time, but just because this is really focused today with the news of the hike in council tax bills. How do you see perhaps that being addressed, or how could the council do better in taking responsibility, as you described?
Well, I think at the moment the council and really all the senior people at the top, pretty much anyone responsible for that is not left at the council now. So I think at the moment the council is going through an extremely challenging set of issues, both their budgets and an improvement programme. And I think it's not the first time we've been here with Birmingham, but I think this time round there is government intervention. There is an awful lot of people working to try and improve standards in Birmingham. And I think I'm hopeful that it you know, it's Europe's largest local authority. I think it should be an absolute bastion of good practice. And that's not what it's been in the past, and it should be in the future.
Heather Jameson, editor of the Municipal Journal. Thank you. Dr. James Brackley, a lecturer in accounting at Sheffield University, talking about those changes announced and what might be coming as well in Birmingham. Birmingham City Council, the largest local authority in Europe. Labour run. We heard a bit and was referred to there about what the Chancellor has said ahead of the budget tomorrow, and also wanting to bring your attention to the way that perhaps it's been framed around the issue of women bringing that equal pay, those equal pay cases, and what's being blamed for the black hole in the council's funding. Interesting, a message here. There's nothing wrong with Oracle as an IT system. The problem is how it has interfaced with existing council systems. Right, someone who's obviously in the know or a bit in the know there. But if you have anything to say about those potential rises and how you're coping at the moment financially, please do get in touch. And the potential for some of those cuts and what you rely on councils for, and also how you think perhaps the perception of women in light of this and where blame is being laid will be affected. So it's always interesting to hear your views. Do get in touch. But if I say the name Yeats to you, who springs to mind? Perhaps the poet W.B. Yeats, or the painter Jack Butler Yeats. But those talented brothers also had two industrious and inspiring sisters. Elizabeth Yeats, also known as Lolly, was a printer and a teacher. Susan Yeats, known as Lily, was an embroiderer. Together, they founded a women-only arts and crafts guild to promote women's economic and cultural independence. They were the backbone of the Irish cultural and literary revival of the 1920s, publishing over 70 books, and their embroidered pieces were commissioned by the Vatican, no less. But the legacy has been overshadowed, and their work by their brothers. A new documentary called Lily and Lolly, The Forgotten Yeats Sisters, is out on the 8th of March, of course, International Women's Day. It's International Women's Day here every day on Women's Hour, I should say, on Sky Arts. And that documentary is hoping to change that, fronted by the Irish singer, songwriter and poet Imelda May, who joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
How did you come to these sisters then?
I was doing a gig in Three Arena in Dublin, and I was wanting to project names of inspiring women behind me while I was singing this particular song all about strength and stoicism, and I started investigating all the different people that I loved and should put up there. And as I was looking through, I came upon the Yeats sisters, and I had no idea, I'd never heard of them. And I'm a W.B. Yeats fan and a Jack Yeats fan since I was a teenager, and I thought this is crazy. I'd seen their portraits painted by their father, but I didn't know anything about them. And the more I researched, the more I was gobsmacked. And I kind of told everybody about them constantly. My cousins and my friends and sisters all got... There was only two books I could find about them. Small snippets of information around, and I just sent them to everybody all the time. And then I met a wonderful woman called Maggie Brannock, that I myself and herself did a wonderful documentary for Sky Arts called Voices of Ireland. I'm saying it's wonderful because we were delighted with it. And then she said, what do you want to work on next? And I said, I totally know. And she'd heard me going on about them and said, let's do this. We really need to tell their story.
And the story is a remarkable one, isn't it? I mean, I also have now educated myself, yeah. and let's share it yeah. with our listeners, because the route at that time for these women would have been to marry, have children,
yeah.
go down that, but they go down a completely different route. How did they come to their arts and crafts work?
Well, they were middle class, you know, upper to middle class women. Their mother was from a really well-off family in Sligo, but their father, who was supposed to be a barrister, decided one day, do you know what, I'm not going to be a barrister, I'm going to be an artist. And then off he went, and the mother got ill. She had a stroke really early and was very ill for a long time. And their brothers went off and did their things. Now, Susan had gone off to study embroidery with William Morris, and Elizabeth was brilliant artist and she was an art teacher. But when this happened, there were no funds coming into the house. There was nothing. And they were still trying to keep up the family, and certainly the father was trying to keep up the appearance of having something and being somebody. At one point he moved them to London. They moved back and forth, and they even had a maid, and the maid documented that when she opened the cupboards there was no food inside. They had nothing. So Susan and Elizabeth basically had to fund the family and roll their sleeves up, as women often do, and decided to make this work. But what I love about them is they didn't just, you know, go out and work and make money for the family. They were true artists, and they used everything they did was very very thoughtful, and they consciously did everything. They thought about everything, the way they employed only women. At that time, it was really, women weren't allowed to be printers. So they started up an embroidery company. They worked, like I said, with William Morris. Then they were involved in the Celtic Revival. They worked with Evelyn Gleeson. So they were embroiderers. They were they started up a publishing company. They were printers. They employed only women, which you could have been arrested for at that time. You certainly would have been brought to court for employing one woman, and they employed only women. They employed young women, older women, widows, and they really invested in the education of the women and in their lives after they left working for them. So they were totally invested in the women that were there and improved their lives.
And were they a success with these endeavours?
Massively, yes. They were massively successful. But they at one point they almost went bankrupt, because with the books, they decided to make these books beautiful, not just to make money. They were trying to source local linens, things that we look to do now, they were doing then, local paper, hand binding. And then they took off. Let me explain to you, with printing at that time, it was only men that were employed in printing, and they had to serve for 7 years, and they were not allowed to get married or to drink, or it was like a vocation for 7 years. Elizabeth decided they were going to print. She went and studied printing for 4 weeks, bought a printing press, and then became the teacher. And that's how
They began.
That's how they began.
And 4 weeks. And it was pretty heavy labour, wasn't it?
Very heavy labour. I've lifted
I believe you do for the programme.
I could hardly lift them up, and they're all lead, and everything was hand done. All the press. And these women were flinging them around. And the other thing that they did, they could have signed, they could have signed well-known writers that were already published, and that would have guaranteed them success within publishing. But they decided they were only going to sign, or mostly going to sign, new and upcoming writers. So they signed J.M. Singh, Patrick Kavanagh, and loads of other people. My mind's gone blank because there's.
But in terms of just writers and how they were then perceived, because that's what's fascinating. You know, there was a pretty horrible reference to them by James Joyce, wasn't there? A reference to them as the Weird Sisters, is that right?
Yeah, and they were kind of seen as irritating, you know, and they were talked about in the difficult. Certainly Elizabeth was known as the difficult sister, and she was the more business-headed of the two, so she was getting things done. And from all the letters that I've read of her, she wasn't difficult at all. She was just, as Sinead O'Connor said, I'm not bossy, I'm the boss. and people didn't like that. But she was really pushing ahead. And
because I mean, we should also say that they did never marry. They lived, they worked together, they carried on with their work.
They never married. The father went off. John went off to America to paint, and he said, "Could you send me some money?" And they sent him. They sent him money for 11 years. They funded him.
So they funded their dad,
yeah,
and who wanted to be an artist and yeah. went off to do that, leaving the law. And the relationship with the brothers, the much more famous brothers that we know the name for.
Jack and them, they got along, and Jack did some artwork. He painted and did some beautiful drawings for them that they then turned into embroidery. So they worked together as a family on that because they were artists too. But William, it was a fractured relationship, as siblings often have. You know, he was back and forth, but he had to come in and sign things, and Elizabeth had to. She was trying to get him to sign things over to her that she would also be able to run the company without his signature, basically.
Well, it's fascinating. Thank you so much for telling
Thank
us
you.
What I'm, you've learned.
I talked really fast because there's so much about them, and we tried to squeeze it into 1 hour of a programme, but there's way, way, way much.
Well, I squeeze everything into 1 hour of a programme every day, and multiple things.
I fell in love with them, and I
can hear that.
They're wonderful women. We owe them a lot. So thank you for giving me the time.
And it sounds, you know, very beautiful as well, especially and being commissioned by all sorts, not least the Vatican, with their creations and having that focus on beauty and the aesthetic.
Oh,
they were
so talented. It's incredible. Their talent was their vision was amazing.
I'm going to get into trouble.
Go on.
If I don't say, Imelda, the name of the programme again, because people always go, hang on, I missed it at the beginning. So yes. It's Lily and Lolly, the Forgotten Yates Sisters on Sky Arts from the 8th of March, created by Imelda May. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
And I'm sure we'll get some response to that. And I'm sure we'll also have some people say, I do know about them. But now I want other people to know about them as well. Very knowledgeable listener base. Spread the word, indeed. Well, last week on the programme, I introduced a new Woman's Hour series about porn and how it's influencing real sex and a sense of ourselves. And today we're going to hear from Sam, not her real name, who's in her late 40s. Her awareness of porn imagery goes back a long way and has had a profound impact on her self-image and sex life. Sam is a recovering sex and love addict herself. The relationship counselling service Relate defines this as any sexual activity that feels, quote, out of control. But experts also agree that simply having lots of sex doesn't necessarily point to a problem. One of Sam's relationships was with a man she thinks was addicted to pornography. And I should say, in what you're about to hear, she uses explicit terms from porn to tell her story. Our reporter, Enna Miller, asks Sam about when she first saw pornography.
I would have been 4 years old. We lived in tenement flats. And I remember like going out into the back garden, and there was like an empty field, and I remember finding pornography. I didn't know it was pornography. And I can still see the woman's kind of like 1970s hair, splayed legs, and just being really confused by it.
Four is very young, so then when did you experience it again?
Probably teenage years, aware that male friends had pornography magazines, maybe always a little bit fascinated in shops and things, and like page three, you know, those kind of Sam Fox, beautiful, pale, blonde woman. And also, I don't know if you remember, those Tennent's lager cans with the women, blonde, beautiful, and kind of like knowing that I was like a brunette, you know, like it didn't quite fit with who I was as a young teenage woman. So I think for me, there was always this maybe not being enough, and pornography was like, oh, this is what I should be and this is what men like. I looked much younger than I was. So I would have been, 25? But when I look at pictures now, there was something that was quite childlike about me. So I definitely had a couple of partners that were very into the brand of porn that would be like Sweet 16. And I would have fitted like, you know, quite small chest. Like I didn't have boobs really until I had babies. And I think I knew that was my category. Definitely schoolgirl kind of like fantasies or younger type of porn inspired role play.
You seem very comfortable with that.
Yeah, I kind of accepted that I would never be enough. So I was always happy to kind of use porn as a reference of like, this is the benchmark of what you have to be like a sweet 16. When the relationship actually ended, it ended because I borrowed a laptop from him. And on the laptop, he had what would be described now as like MILF porn. So it was an older, it was a woman being ejaculated on. I remember she was very fat. And I just remember like being really confused because I was like, that's what he likes looking at.
Is it not okay to like two different things?
I was confused. And I think you do have quite linear thinking at that age. Whereas now, as you get older, you can fully see the plethora of like, ooh, I love, you know, all different colours of skin. I love all body shapes. Do you know what I mean? I see Eros in everything.
I feel you're a bit of a rebel. And I've only known you 10 minutes.
I'm no longer schoolgirl now. I'm in the MILF category. And again, that's like so boring.
When you were the people pleaser, okay, was there times you were enjoying yourself?
There's definitely been times in my life where I've allowed pornography to be in the bedroom. VHS tapes of, you know, lesbian porn or whatever it was. I think there was one bondage one that's coming into my head. Women being hung up and kind of whipped and my partner's watching the VHS and using me as a body. So not engaging with me at all.
So when you were in that moment, you're telling me that he's watching a VHS and then you are there. What are you doing?
I mean, there's a lot of times when you're like self-pleasuring or you're doing stuff for yourself because there's this disconnect. It's like a virtual menage a trois when you've got pornography in the room. So I think there's a difference from the porn that I experienced in my 20s, which was probably just kind of quite pretty, quite glamorous. You know, it was much more about like lipstick and high heels. And pornography in my 20s was very different to the pornographies that was introduced to me in my 40s, which was definitely much more hardcore. What people do, that's weird. Oh my God, like it's not even enough to be penetrated by one penis, it has to be two.
Did pornography ever enter your life without having somebody there, as in just for your own pleasure?
Where I would enjoy pornography is, you know, because I like looking at beautiful women. Like as a young woman, there was a fascination with those magazines and what was in them. And that was maybe a little bit tantalising. But I certainly never bought a porn magazine. Do you know what I mean? That would have been bizarre. 30s, maybe occasionally, but not so much because I was like in the world of motherhood and like having babies. So no, in my 40s, reintroduced to pornography through another person, although I have watched content that was sent to me. Over the past couple of years, I have explored like online dating apps, but there is one particular app and I didn't realise it's got this function and it opens up into video mode. You open them up and it's just somebody masturbating. I have had one moment of self-pleasuring where this really cute guy in America who was in an office must have been, what, I don't know if it was the beginning of his shift or the, well, like, do you know what I mean? It's 10 o'clock, half 10 my time. He was really cute and he asked really nicely. He was like, oh, yeah, do you want to have some fun? And that's what we did. He asked permission before he showed his penis and things and, you know, he asked me what I was into and what I wanted to be called or what the kind of narrative was. So actually setting the scene up in that space where it's real time and I'm consenting as an adult and so is he, I'm down with that. You know what I mean? That for me is more fair trade, ethical. We both gave each other a virtual helping hand in a sense. I want to dance. I want to shag. I've been quite interested in younger men. I've refused to get into sexting or texting. Like, that's something that I don't do anymore. Like, I have to be careful because as a love and sex addict, for me, like, actually what I should be striving for is actually true connection and deep connection.
But you enjoyed yourself.
Pornography is it's a beast, isn't it? It just needs a constant stream of new things, weird things, nothing sacred. Everything can be fetishized and wanked on. We can mix a bit of this with that. Even with my own experience of like dating a a porn addict. It starts off quite vanilla, and then by the end of it, it's just so extreme.
So you dated one. How did it start?
So he would have been my teenage love from when I was 13. He would have been 19. Yeah, when I was 16, I actually lost my virginity with him. He got in touch. My dad had passed, and I remember at the time just being like really, like my head was really messed up. So he phoned up just to, you know, say sorry. He knew how I felt, to connect. And then it really quickly turned into this strange conversation of, like, he asked me, was I having sex?
Was that in the first conversation?
Yeah. He overshared with me about his wife intimately. They weren't having sex. And then he kind of playfully was like, oh, everybody needs to have sex. Everybody needs to have sex. And I kind of just laughed. And then for all of the stuff that was happening, definitely there's something for me now that I know. When grief happens to me, I can sexualize it in weird ways as a coping mechanism, because I am, like, you know, I'm a bit of an addict. So even like when my granddad died, I found myself in a strip club after the funeral with five blokes I didn't know. The first time I put WhatsApp on my phone was at his suggestion. Then it was like a barrage of messages and things.
Like what?
Like love bombing. Of like, oh, you're beautiful, you're wonderful, you're this, you know. And then, yeah, he just wanted pictures.
At some point, did it become exciting?
It was intense. And even when I was looking through some of the messages that I've kept, I was just aware of like, oh God, we were both in like fantasy role play.
Can we have a look?
Streams and streams.
I'm reading this over your shoulder.
That's
is this
okay? That's okay.
This one you're about to read me, this is at 19 minutes past three at night. And then it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It's like every second. You're texting through the night, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. At 5 a.m. you tell him horny and he goes yummy. Oh, you send an attachment.
Yeah, I said.
At 7 a.m. Do you want to say what you said?
I'm a fan of Bush.
And then?
Yummy. He says that. And I say, no, too hairy.
I know, but I'm just trying to see when you stop talking.
It was continual. He was into the idea of watching me have sex with other people. Mm-hmm. Will you come too? What will you wear? He was always really into, like, I'm your slut, what do you want me to wear? Please, can I come? I've been edging for longer than normal.
What's edging?
Edging is like you're waiting to get permission from your partner to come. A lot of porn addicts maybe do it because it's just about taking longer and then it feels better. So sometimes with this person, he could be edging for days. And it would be a constant flow of like pictures, images. These are pictures that we started using to send to various apps and online profiles to start doing things together as a couple. It was very much like on his terms, and I knew my place. I was just there for his occasional fun, and it was going to involve other people.
And part of you was up for it?
Oh, yeah. But I always knew it was going to be enticing. As a codependent woman with a man who's a porn addict, I certainly knew how to manipulate and titillate. But all of it was quite sad. Like, he decided that he would take over, like I was saying, almost like my PA. He would do all of that side of it, which actually I enjoyed because, you know, I wasn't particularly fussed about meeting people. But for him, it was like there was definite fantasies that he wanted me and him to play around with and try things out. But I had real feelings for him. You know, I remember like meeting him in this hotel, and I remember feeling really beautiful and sexy. Oh, he basically just wanted to come in my face. He wanted to have sex with me. And then he was like working. And I remember having this real disconnect from like the fantasy of what I thought it would be, and the reality was like really quite uncomfortable. Like It was just a crazy relationship, like crazy in terms of what I would do, the lengths of what you would do. And then when you get your 40s, like if it hasn't been successful, you kind of do this thing where you go through all your past relationships and you're like, oh God, maybe that one would have worked, maybe that one would have worked. And where I think I was really accepting with this relationship and this person was like, you know, I see porn addiction just in the way as I see alcoholism. You know, as a good codependent woman, there I was supporting all of the needs of this porn addicted man. I was willing to go above and beyond and be like, whoa, I'm fabulous, I'm this, I'm that. Maybe as I get older, I'm much more comfortable with my sexuality and how flamboyant that can be or how I like to express it. I need to look after myself and my own needs. Well, we get told as women, we're meant to stop feeling things once we get to a certain age. I think like I'm still going to be 90 and I'll still feel juicy and I'll still want to be like doing whatever I'm doing, because I think that's part of who I am as a creative woman. You know, it's not going away, even through all this perimenopausal stuff. When I speak to older women, they kind of laugh and they're like, no, it's, you know, I think you're taught this idea that it's meant to end or it is going to end, but actually I think I'm only just beginning.
Thank you very much to Sam there, not her real name, and Anna Miller was the reporter there. So far in our new porn series, we have spoken to women, but obviously it's a conversation that men need to be involved with too. So we should say male listeners have been in touch. One email saying, don't care for porn myself, but my partner used to say it warmed her up, that she became less inhibited and it helped her have an orgasm. Another reads, I gave up porn when I realised I was actively seeking out weirder and even borderline nasty. The divide between naughty and nasty is quite narrow. We would like to speak to men of different ages, backgrounds, and find out how porn has shaped your sex lives and relationships. A bit of an idea of some of the messages there. Please do keep getting in touch. We do want men to join the conversation. It's not about judgment. Do share your thoughts and experiences. The same numbers I gave before, but just to share again, the number is 84844 for texts, on social media at BBC Woman's Hour, or email us through the Woman's Hour website, or send a WhatsApp message on 03700 100 444. And women, keep getting in touch too. I hope I don't need to say that, but just in case.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome. Like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I do. Now, 2 years after the US Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to abortion, lawmakers in France yesterday made history by enshrining this right into their country's constitution, a global first. Parliamentarians voted to revise the country's 1958 constitution to enshrine women's guaranteed freedom to abort. The overwhelming 780-72 vote saw a standing ovation in Parliament in Versailles, where the result was announced. Following the vote, the Eiffel Tower in Paris was lit up in celebration with the message, my body, my choice. Anti-abortion groups have strongly criticised the change, as has the Vatican. Well, on the line, Stéphanie Hennet-Vauchez is a professor of public law at the Paris Nanterre University and a French constitutional expert. Stéphanie, I've tried to paint a picture. Welcome to Woman's Hour of what happened. Tell us a bit more.
Hi. It's the completion of a 18 months process. I think that there had been some conversation about enshrining abortion in the Constitution before. But of course, the Dobbs decision, as you recalled, really sparked this movement. And it's been a very interesting 18 months. It started out in a much more robust language than what we actually have put in the Constitution by the vote yesterday. Initially, the National Assembly voted a language that really spoke of a right and located this new right to an effective right to abortion in the Constitution independently. Whereas what has been passed yesterday is slightly different. It speaks of a guaranteed liberty, guaranteed freedom, as you said. And also, it's not a freestanding article in the Constitution. It's just listed among the competences of the parliament. So what this means is that it's a right, but it's indirectly a right. It's first and foremost defined as a domain of legislative competence. And it's basically the Constitution telling the lawmakers, the parliament as the author of legislation, that if and when they regulate abortion, they have to do so in one particular direction. And that direction is that they need to protect the guaranteed freedom to have an abortion.
And I suppose in terms of what, because it sounds like, you correct me if I'm wrong, that not necessarily anything changes day to day in women's lives. But is it the symbolism of that? I mean, there are obviously legal ramifications of a constitutional change. I'm not saying there aren't. But what do you think the signal it sends?
Right. No, you're absolutely right. It doesn't change anything in either the access of women to abortion locally as of today, or it doesn't even change the rules as they exist. For example, abortion on demand is legal up to the 14th week, and that is not changing just because of the constitutional amendment. The symbolism is important, of course, because, you know, this would be or this is the first constitutional text to explicitly refer to abortion as a guaranteed right. So that, of course, means something for women's groups and activists worldwide. And it also means more than that. I mean, it's not just the symbolism of it, but the idea is also that the French constitution makers really wanted to prevent any kind of future regression in the legislation. So the idea really is that if the political feeling around abortion and reproductive rights was to change in the future in France, this constitutional amendment would legitimize the intervention of the Constitutional Court to strike down any legislation that would go too far in restricting abortion rights as we know them today, because it could be read as a violation of this newly constitutionally guaranteed freedom.
Not everyone is happy with this, although it does seem that the majority is, but not everyone is.
No, not everyone is. But as you said, I mean, there's a wide support. The polling that's been going on over the past year and a half has consistently indicated anything between 75% and 85% of the people in support of the constitutionalization of abortion rights. As you said, there's been a big a celebration in the streets of Paris yesterday. I think it's important to understand that in France, I mean, although, of course, there are opponents to abortion and there were opponents to this constitutional amendments, it is an issue that is much less polarized than in many other countries. There has been a sort of incremental, progressive equilibrium found throughout 50 years of repeated legislative interventions since the historical decriminalization in 1975. And I think the issue is much less polarized, and it was indeed very striking yesterday to hear the language that was employed pretty much across the spectrum, the political spectrum, in the joint session of people celebrating, feminist slogans like "Your body, your choice" was actually spoken by the Prime Minister himself.
Yes, and that was very striking, and as well what was going on at the Eiffel Tower, as I mentioned. It'll be fascinating to see if the success of this French campaign will strengthen other abortion rights movements across the globe, how that impact may happen. We'll watch this space. Perhaps you'll come back to tell us should things change. Stéphanie Hennette-Vauchez, thank you very much for your analysis and putting it into greater context for you. the singer and songwriter Sarah Jane Morris, who's just walked into the studio and is lip-syncing along to that, of course, performing with groups from 1980s pop synth act, the Communards, to, I should say, a hugely varied career, the Soweto Voice Choir, and her work crosses genres, rock to soul to African blues, classical orchestras, jazz, big bands, you name it. And now, a new album. She's published herself, The Sisterhood, which celebrates 10 women that blaze their own musical trails. We'll get into some of them. Good morning.
Good morning.
What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you at last.
And to hear your voice, your speaking voice, as well as what you do when you sing. The Sisterhood, you're speaking to Woman's Hour. Tell us more.
So The Sisterhood started in the second lockdown. I'm going to be like Imelda May and talk very quickly because because there's so much to say.
But get some of it out.
So I moved to St Leonard's-on-Sea just before the lockdown. And first lockdown, walked and walked and walked, destroyed my knees, needed a new leg, knee anyway. And then in the second lockdown, I thought, I'd like to find out about all those female singer-songwriters that paved the way for someone like me. And I made a list of 50. And then when I realised it could be an album, I took it down to 10. We have extended it to 12, actually, since. But on the album, it's 10. And I did a lot of research. And with my husband, we read to each other. We don't have a television. So we sit across from each other and read to each other. And I bought autobiographies and biographies of all of these singers that I'd chosen. And we made notes. And between us, we wrote their life story very respectfully. And then Tony Remy, who's my right-hand, left-hand man and my co-writer for many years, who was Annie Lennox's guitarist for 12 years, he came down when we had free movement. And we both together in my front room decided to write each song in the musical genre of the singer that I'd written about, which stretched us. It called on everything we had ever learnt in our long careers. And it did take us to South Africa, because one of the singers I wrote about who was very important in my education was Miriam Makeba. And I did a GoFundMe where people pre-ordered the CD, and that paid for myself and Tony and my brother Rod Morris, who's a filmmaker, to go to Johannesburg. And we stayed there with someone who had been a boyfriend of mine in the 80s, and he had, with Gerry Dammers, set up Artists Against Apartheid. He was the son of Oliver Tambo, who was the head of the ANC. So he allowed us to come and stay with him. In fact, we landed in Tambo Airport, named after his father, and stayed with the Tambos.
Amazing.
And recorded with the Soweto Gospel Choir on the day that Miriam Makeba would have turned 90 had she lived.
Wow. And I mean, that's one story, and we could keep going with that, but there are many other women that you've been looking into, as you say. And on the album, you pay tribute to Janis Joplin, Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, Billie Holiday, Joni Mitchell, a great list.
Yeah.
And today you're going to perform a song inspired by Ricky Lee Jones. Can you tell us a bit about her?
Yes, well, she was a gift to a songwriter. Her grandfather was a one-legged tap dancer in vaudeville called Peg Leg Jones.
Wow.
Gift.
Okay.
And she was hitching around America at age 12. She was for 1 year before either of them broke the partner of Tom Waits. They both influenced each other. But she talked in her book about how she was influenced musically by Van Morrison. So when we were writing her lyric, we kind of leaned towards that. Because, of course, he did the bright side of the road, and we call her song the jazz side of the road. But it's all about her incredible journey in her song.
And the song itself, what are you trying to get across? Or how are you trying to help people understand her, do you think, through this?
Well,
it's always nice if someone's about, you know, people are about to hear something, if they can be thinking what you're trying to do.
Well, I think I'm celebrating how individual they all are. And how brave most of them were, you know. I mean, in the case of Billie Holiday, she continually sung the song Strange Fruit, even though the FBI tried to destroy her career again and again and again. They would undercover sell her heroin and then lock her away for the same thing. And her bravery to sing that song, that's what our song's about. It's called Junk in My Trunk. But with Ricky, she actually wrote to me, because it was the first single, and she wrote to me and I haven't got it here, so I can't actually quote her, but it was as good as saying, "Thank you for telling my truth. I cried."
Well, that's an endorsement, isn't it?
It certainly
When you're looking to try and see perhaps how you can connect. Well, I'm going to let you go over to the microphone because we are going to hear Sarah Jane Morris now performing a song inspired by Ricky Lee Jones, Jazz Side of the Road, accompanied by Tim Cansfield and, as you're hearing, Tony Remy on acoustic guitars. I'll let you take it away. Sarah Jane Morris, accompanied by Tim Cansfield and Tony Remy on acoustic guitars with Jazz Side of the Road, a song inspired by Ricky Lee Jones. And I should say, Sarah Jane, singing again with Tim and Tony on those guitars, will be performing at the Tongue Auditorium in Liverpool on Friday and at the Alexandra Palace Theatre, London, on Saturday. And the album, bringing those ideas together, is called The Sisterhood, especially ahead of, I know, many celebrations that will be coming for women with International Women's Day with us on Friday. But as I've already said, it's every day here on Woman's Hour. So I'll be back with you tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hello, I'm David Yelland.
And I'm Simon Lewis. We're the hosts of Radio 4's When It Hits the Fan, the podcast which looks at how big names and big companies manage their PR.
But what about your own personal PR? How do you better manage your own reputation at work? We're here to help. With a series of special bonus episodes, we'll bring a little wisdom and share some tips to hopefully make you better at that job.
Quick Wins is a series of short and snappy episodes with lots of advice aimed at improving your working life. If that sounds useful, then please listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds. Just search for When It Hits the Fan.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.